Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're frequently told that America is a Christian nation, but we aren't told what kind of Christian that is. There are many faces of Christianity with huge differences in philosophy and practice. And so, as many sing, they want that old-time religion. We might be surprised to learn that there may not be such a thing as an actual old-time religion. This is explored in the book American Christian, The Continuing Revolution. We're joined by the author Stephen Cox. He is a professor of literature and the director of the humanities program at the University of California, San Diego. And Stephen, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you, David.
So, Stephen, why did you write the book, American Christianity, The Continuing Revolution?
Well, you know, I've written a lot of books, and one of my books was about the New Testament and literature with a lot of applications to American literature. And it just struck me more and more that American Christianity was a lot more interesting than people have been led to believe, a lot more colorful, a lot more diverse, a lot more volatile and unpredictable, filled with interesting people and interesting personal decisions. So I wanted to explore that, and it was great fun to do so.
Many incredible characters. They're charismatic, and I guess that's just one of the things you have to be in order to be someone who can lead one of these revivals and crusades. But do you think that many people in the United States today have this nostalgia for this faith of our fathers, but that faith of our fathers never really existed? That nostalgia is more like a celebration of a myth?
Well, you know, there are myths that are actually true. And, you know, to a degree, you know, it is true that there were various versions of an old-time religion. I mean, there has been religion as an important part of American history from the very beginning. But to try to find something stable, you know, you can point your finger at it, that's the way our great-grandparents thought and acted. No, that's a myth in the sense that it's false. It's a false story. It's a nostalgic story. And it's not usually a very colorful story either. You know, I'm struck by the fact that Americans remain very religious, but most of us don't even really know the history of our own churches, don't really understand how interesting they have been and what changes they've gone through. I mean, the history of the church is just those pictures of old ladies and gentlemen and the church hall. You know, it all looks so boring. It all looks so stable in the worst sense. So I think we should see the dynamism and the colorful nature of American Christianity. That's really our tradition and our heritage.
And by exploring that and making that more well known, how does that inform us today about the state of religious, you know, how people celebrate religion today?
Well, I think it gives us perspective for one thing. Well, I mean, first of all, I should just say again, it's a lot of fun. And there's nothing wrong in knowing about the history of your own faith if you have faith, or other people's faith if you don't. But more than that, it does give us historical perspective. Now, whenever you hear a statement of alarm about how Americans are losing their religion, or they have too much religion, or religion is too intrusive, if you know the history of America, you see that you know, these things have happened before, and usually in much more dynamic and interesting ways than they're happening right now.
You mean like scandals?
Sort of sit back and enjoy it a bit.
You mean like these colorful scandals that'll pop up from time to time? And we've been here before. This is not new.
Oh, my God, yes.
So what are some of the big scandals that you write about in the book?
Well, you know, you can go back to the 19th century. Henry Ward Beecher was America's most prominent preacher and a very interesting character, an intelligent man. And certainly he had a peculiar kind of charisma. He looked like a frog. But,
and he's the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the writer of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the
right.
son of also a prominent preacher.
Yes, both in the whole family is involved in the abolition movement and the prohibition movement, all sorts of movements, and they're all interesting characters. One of the interesting things about religious charisma is that you can't predict who's going to have it. You know, when you look at pictures of Henry Ward Beecher and you hear about how eccentric, you learn about how eccentric he was, you think, how could he attract a huge audience? I mean, people would line up to go to his church. Abraham Lincoln had wanted to come and come to the church, and somebody had to get up and give him his seat because the church was packed and it would hold thousands of people. But Henry Ward Beecher in the 1870s was involved in a terrific sex scandal about when somebody sued him for alienating the affections of this man's wife. And their friends dumped all the extensive correspondence about everybody's romantic relationships into the popular press. And it was this probably the biggest religious scandal in American history.
So when you talk about this being – is this an American phenomenon, the way the Christianity, this continuing revolution that you write about?
Well, history changes in every country, but I think American religious traditions are – I mean the tradition of a dynamic, volatile religion is really an American thing, and it comes back – it goes back to – the fact that we don't have a state church, and we were the first real country that did not have a state church. And also from the modernization of American culture that took place almost 200 years ago, when you began to have people collecting in fairly large cities. And then you have choices of churches to go to. And that's when the field really breaks open. And that's when people become much more actively religious, too. In about 1800, fewer than 20% of Americans were really affiliated with a church, you know, really went to it, really supported it. They were almost all nominal Christians, but they weren't very involved in religion. 100 years later, over 50% were closely affiliated with a church, and now the figure is something like 60%. Now, one thing that happened was that if you live in a rural area where there's just one church to go to and you don't like that church, you might say, well, I'm a Christian or I'm a, you know, a Methodist or something, but you're not really affiliated with it. But you go to a fairly large town, and that town will have a church for you. And churches began to figure out ways of identifying themselves to find an audience. There's a tremendous religious revolution, and that continues. It's never stopped.
Yeah, I read in your book that in 1776, only 17% of Americans adhered to a church.
Yes, that's a pretty good figure.
And so you that's when people talk, you know, about the founding fathers and the founding of a Christian nation. Obviously, their idea of Christianity was very different than what many people have today, if only 17% of Americans at the time were actually regular church-going folk.
Well, I think that does make a difference, but also you have to come down to the question of individual character, which I continue to emphasize in my book, because it's individuals who make choices and individuals who have attitudes. And when you look at the people who signed the Declaration of Independence or participated in the Constitutional Convention, you see a pretty full spectrum of religious views and involvements.
Yeah. So one of the big things, big themes in the book is the conflict between churches and the orthodoxy and being able to get involved with the culture. We're going to talk more about that as we come back from this break. Also about this, the themes, all these big personalities and how we have this marketplace of ideas of about religion in the United States. And that might be why we've seen so much of a innovation in religion and Christianity here in the United States. Well, we're talking about American Christianity with Stephen Cox. He's written the book. If you're invited to join the conversation, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. You can also email us your questions and comments to the source at tpr.org. We will be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Stephen Cox. He's written the book American Christianity and the Continuing Revolution. And as we went to break, Stephen, I was asking you about the United States. And, you know, we have this freedom of ideas, marketplace of ideas. Do you think that is one of the reasons why we've seen so much innovation in Christianity in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. When people are free to choose, you have to identify what is available to their choice. I mean, right now the internet is a tremendous mechanism for choice of religion and choice of churches within a given religion, because you can go there and you can look and see what it's like to go to such and such a church. And a lot of people drive 50, 60 miles to go to a church that they really like, and they found it on the Internet.
Let's go to the phone lines. Our number is 614-8980, 614-8980, if you want to jump into the conversation talking about the history of Christianity in America and where we are today. Hugh has called in. Hugh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, in 1776, there weren't any bishops in America. And without any bishops, you couldn't be confirmed if you were Catholic or Anglican. And you couldn't take communion or you couldn't go to Mass, which cut you right out of the church. The reason was that the British were darned if they were going to let a Catholic bishop into the colonies, and they wanted the colonials to come back to Britain and get confirmed there and get another coat of Britishness and then return.
Well, and the American Episcopalians, as they're now called, the Anglicans, the members of the Church of England, resisted having a bishop in this country, even though that branch of the church was the established religion in places like Virginia, because they didn't want to pay for it and they didn't want a religious authority.
So would that have this situation that Hugh brings up? Those are some great points, Hugh. Thanks for calling in. Would that have repressed the number of people that would actually go to church? Stephen?
Oh, yes, absolutely. For instance, just to take the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church, as it's now called, if you wanted to be ordained as a priest in that church, you had to go back to England, just as he said, and you had a 20% chance of perishing on the voyage. So you can imagine how many Americans wanted to do that. So the church in America was largely served by people who were sent out from England, often because they were drunks or they had debts or they got in trouble in some way. And you can imagine how much the parishioners would want to support those people.
Right. So how did that change? How did that evolve into after the Revolution? Were we allowed to have our own priest?
Well, yes, absolutely. And then the American church, the Episcopal church, put itself together and figured out a way to get bishops ordained and figured out a way to recover from the immense disaster of the American Revolution, which had separated them from the mother church, and began to do very well, thank you, and to support themselves. You know, a bishop of the Episcopal church back then probably, had his own farm, kept his own cow, didn't expect to be paid very much, if anything, for being a bishop. And this began to give people personal authority.
So what about, politics and religion? We're told that this is a new phenomenon, but you're saying in the book that, no, this has happened before.
Yes. If you think about the Prohibition movement, which began sort of out of nowhere in the 1820s, and its conquest of America, I mean, what an immense involvement of the church in politics that was. And, churches from about the 1820s on have never stopped being involved in politics, both on the left side of the spectrum, whatever the spectrum was at the time, as well as the right side of the spectrum. We hear a lot about right-wing churches, but the religious left has been very powerful in this country also and continues to be that way.
And we've had these great awakenings in the United States over the years, one particularly before the Revolution. Tell me, why are those so significant, and why do they happen with this like cyclicalness?
Well, I don't think they happen cyclically. I think that they happen. And you can try to explain them sociologically, but I don't think that works. I think that they remain mysterious, because human beings are mysterious. But the first Great Awakening began in the 1830s, and that's significant partly because it was the first mass movement in American history. The second Great Awakening began about 1800 and really took hold in the 1820s, and this also was the kind of mass movement that America had never seen before. And out of these movements came churches like the Methodist Church, which in 1850 had about a quarter of Americans as affiliated with it, the Disciples of Christ Church, the Christian Church. Other churches, institutions were founded out of these movements that are still very important today.
And you write that before we had mass media, that churches are going to crusades-type events, this was entertainment for people.
Well, of course it's entertainment. I mean, religion always has that function of entertaining. If you know, who wants to go to a church that he's not interested in? You know, just who wants to go and be bored? You know, you do want to be entertained. Of course, the thing about religion is it has to be a certain kind of entertainment. It can't be just entertainment. If the churches that try to offer entertainment that's just like what you would get from the secular world, from turning on TV, generally go under because they don't have product differentiation.
So as you tell the story of this constant progress, the continuing revolution of American Christianity. So does that mean something in the sense that the religion that we celebrate today in the way that we celebrate today, it hasn't always been in a static ideology, that it has continued to ebb and flow?
Well, let me put it in two ways, briefly. One is that there are certain things that remain. The Bible remains, for instance. But what do you find in the Bible? One thing you find in the Bible is an emphasis on conversion, on change, on the dynamic features of the self, on your ability to change and find a new religion. So it's sort of built into Christianity that there's going to be that dynamic. So that's one aspect of it. Another one is, I don't care what church you're affiliated with or know about, if you go back 100 years or 150 years and picture yourself walking into a church of that denomination, it's not going to be probably even remotely the same as your experience today.
But as in the United States, have we seen mainly a peaceful cohabitation of different religions and nothing that would make us think that we need that they can't get along, despite all these different changes and different faces of Christianity?
Well, I think that's basically true, although to get along, you don't have to like one another. In the 19th century, churches got along, even though probably most members of most churches thought that the others were going to hell because they had mistaken the kind of Christianity that was true.
So, because we've seen, like, in Europe, such huge, you know, basically wars that broken out over religion. Do you think that by having freedom of religion, separating church and state in the United States, that we've been able to avoid that because no one has the upper hand?
Absolutely. You take the weapons of carnal warfare out of the hands of the churches and the religious people, and you have the situation that we have now in which people are actually much more interested in Christianity than they are in countries that had a state religion or continue to have it, a much more vital religion because it's left to individual choice, and also they can't hurt each other.
Right, and so you'd mentioned Billy Graham. You write about Billy Graham in the book. What were his contributions?
Well, I think he was the last great evangelist in the sense that he could assemble a very large crowd. You know, Yankee Stadium, he could fill Yankee Stadium for five or six nights on a row and fill a television audience around the country, too. But he was able to see that in the age of television and particular age of modern times, you can't be as flamboyant as the earlier evangelists were. It just doesn't look good on TV. It just sort of scares people. So Billy Graham came across as a nice guy, and a guide and an advisor. He never said, "Well, you're going to hell," as some earlier evangelists did. So he adapted to modern culture, but that's what Christianity is always doing. Maybe adapting is the wrong word. It's finding ways to reach modern people.
But you also write that he did learn from his predecessors like Billy Sunday?
He did. He learned from the flamboyant people in the past, and he honored their memory, as I think my book does too, because they're so much fun. And he realized that you have to be a real person with a real message. That's what he got from them. And it has to be a religious message. It can't be, well, I'm going to give a talk about sociology. I'm just going to advise you how to vote. I'm going to give you some advice about morality. Those may be parts of American religion, but they can't be the basis of it. It's got to be something that's, well, religious, irreducibly religious. And he found that in them, and he was able to deliver that in his own way.
And your book also makes note of architecture as churches, as they are built and as they are adapted, and some are only half built. Why is that important as we look at American Christianity?
I think it's important in too many ways to list. But when you think about, gee, maybe I'll go to church, what comes into your head? A building. What kind of a building? Do you want to go to a church that's modern? Well, gee, that one looks too much like a factory. Well, that one looks like a store. Do you want to go to a Gothic church or a colonial church? Oh, gee, that's the old-time religion, maybe in a dull way. These thoughts are going through your head. Architecture identifies the religious experience and enhances it. It's an integral part of the religious experience. And you look around you at the various kinds of churches in your community and just ask yourself, you know, how does their architecture fit in with how they're identifying themselves? And once you identify yourself, you know, you have a tendency to become more like yourself. So it's an intensifying, it's a way of intensifying the differentiation of your religion.
And you have these Gothic-looking old temples. It looks like you're really celebrating something that's been around for many, many years, even though that's actually a facade.
Well, it's a facade, but it enables a certain kind of religious experience that maybe you wouldn't be able to have otherwise.
All right, Stephen Cox, thank you so much. The author of
thank
American
you.
Christianity, The Continuing Revolution, published by UT Press. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.